As I mentioned earlier in our worship, we're on our theme is sent for the last part of the year. And we've been thinking about some of the places to which we are sent in terms of our family and home, in terms of our work, and then in terms of the public square out there in society. And we discovered last week that we are called to be in the public square, in the marketplace. Why? Because human society was created by God, it is ruled by God, and God is in the process of redeeming it. So therefore, what we do with 95% of our lives, which is lived outside of church events and activities, outside of worship and prayer and fellowship here in Carnmoney, what we do with the rest of our time is also part of the mission of God, because he made society and he calls us to bless that society through our living. And he created it, he rules it, he redeems it. So it's easy then. Yeah, right. It's not as simple as that, is it? Not as simple as that. So to all of you who appreciated last week's sermons and who texted and emailed and so on during the week, and we're encouraged and challenged, what I have to tell you is last week was the good news, okay? This week is the bad news. This same world, which was created by God, is ruled by God, and is being redeemed by God, this same world is also a place of hostility and opposition to the mission of God, and therefore a place of hostility and opposition to those who are involved in the mission. And what I want to think about today is the other side of the coin, if you like. If, as a result of being committed to the mission of God, we find ourselves in a situation of hostility in the world in which we live, how are we meant to respond to that? What does the Bible say? What does Jesus say about our life in this context? And I want to suggest this morning that as a result of the fact that we are called into this position of hostility, we are called to do three things. The first one is we are called to confront. We are called to confront. Now, as a people here in Northern Ireland, we have made a virtue of confrontation. It's what we do. We love it when a public representative we like is telling one we don't like the way it is. We love that. It's great television. We can't have a parade without a protest. And it doesn't seem to matter what we do, but we've always got to be doing it in one another's faces. And when I was in Seaview Church, the Patent Commission was doing its report on the RUC, and they were holding public meetings all across Belfast, and they wanted to hold a public meeting for the kind of Shore Road area, and they asked if they could do it in our church halls. And so we gave them the church halls, and Chris Patton came along with about four members of the commission that he was working with, and anyone who wanted to could come to the meeting to express an opinion. Now, the night before they came to us on the Shore Road, they were on the White Rock. And there was clips played on the evening news that evening before they came to our church of the kind of ruckus that went on at White Rock in this public meeting about the police. Well, I can tell you that was like a Sunday school picnic compared to what the meeting in our church halls was like. And my jaw hit the floor at several points in the night, because here were these people, loads of them I knew, some of them were members of my church, attacking Chris Patton and the commission sitting in the hall with all the venom they could muster. I wanted to tell them about how policing was rubbish. They wanted to tell them about what they thought. One guy who was a loyalist paramilitary leader who's now dead, actually was shot just a few months after this meeting. A guy that I had got to know quite well came to the meeting with large photographs he had printed out on sheets of paper showing the bruises to his body that he had received from the police special squad the last time he'd been involved in a riot in Tigers Bay, and how badly he had been beaten up, and he wanted an end to this special squad and no more of these people, and he wanted them drummed out of the police. And it went on like this all night. And they said, you know, what happened to community policemen, you know, the man that lives near to us and knows us and all the rest of it? Well, I knew what happened to community policemen. They put them out of the community. You couldn't live there if you were a policeman anymore because of the people who live on the Shore Road. They put them out. And this is the way it went on. It was truly dreadful. But it's what we do. I was talking afterwards to a member of the commission who came from South Africa. And he said to me after the meeting was over, he came to thank me for what he regarded as a fairly courageous intervention that I had made at one point in the meeting by saying something to a particular paramilitary representative that didn't exactly enamor me to him. He came to thank me for having said what I said. And then he said, you know what he said the difference is between here and White Rock? I said, no, what's the difference? He said, the people in White Rock know exactly what they want the police to do. People in this community haven't got a clue. He was so right. It was just endless criticism and fighting and confrontation and in your face. It was truly horrendous. This is not what we are called to do. We are called to confront, but not like that. That is not how we are called to confront. To tell us how to relate to our world in terms of confrontation, Jesus used two metaphors, two pictures, rather than giving specific instructions. I love the way Jesus does that. Frequently, that's what he does. He gives a picture, but he doesn't go into detail about it. He lets you work that out for yourself and your circumstance. And he gives us two pictures. He says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And as I've already said to the kids, they needed salt in Jesus' day because meat, especially in such a hot climate, will go off. Things do. I came into the church here yesterday. Christine was doing the flowers. And I came in to let her in. And we came in through the door over there. And the smell in the vestibule was gross. I thought, what is that? And so I hooked around and looked around to see if I could find where the smell was coming from. And I traced it eventually to the black bag that was in the bin in there. So I rapidly tied the black bag up and took it outside. Because the problem is when you leave stuff, it must have been milk or something like that. When you leave stuff around, it goes off. And so in Jesus' day, they had no fridges. They had no means of storing things. So they used salt. Meat was dipped in a brine solution or had salt vigorously rubbed into it. And it halted decay. Salt was a preservative. It stopped things going bad. And they needed light in Jesus' day because it got dark for roughly half the day. And therefore, you needed light to be able to see to get around in your homes in the evening time. And Jesus says, in every place we go, we confront the evil all around us by being salt and light. He's calling us to be different. He's calling us to be holy. That's what it means, to be different. Like, he is different. We don't change society by condemning it. In fact, you know what? If we condemn society, we are really condemning ourselves. Why? Well, if the meat has gone bad, there's no point blaming the meat. It's not the meat's fault. If the meat has gone bad, where's the salt? And if the room is dark, there's no point blaming the room for being dark. Where is the light? So if we are condemning society all around us for being in decay or for being in darkness, who's to blame? The people who are the salt and the people who are the light. So if we condemn, if our approach is constant condemnation and criticism, and we do our confrontation that way, we're actually condemning ourselves because we have failed. Rather, we are meant to stand out as people who live life differently, who follow the beat of a different drum. I don't know if you like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I like the first movie, not the second one. Well, it's all right, but the first movie I think is better. And there's a scene this is the scene in the first movie, okay? The chocolate factory has dispensed with all of the children bar one, and you just love to see them all going because they're a bunch of wee brats. If you've watched the movie, you'll see, okay? And it's just lovely how each one of them gets their comeuppance in the movie, okay? But there's only one left, and that's Charlie. And this is the end of the movie, okay? And the deal in the movie is that the chocolate factory owner, Mr. Wonka, has a special invention, which is the everlasting gobstopper. I haven't had a gobstopper in years. But I used to buy them on the way to school in Derry when I was a boy going to school with the money I was supposed to spend on the bus. But those were days whenever actually you could walk home. Imagine in those days, you know, you were a six-year-old, you could get on the bus to get home and nobody worried about that. Amazing. Anyway, couldn't do that now. But this was an everlasting gobstopper. No matter how much you sucked it and how long you had it, it would never wear out, okay? And so during the course of the visit, each one of them gets an everlasting gobstopper. And Mr. Wonka's competitor, before they go into the chocolate factory with their golden ticket, tells every one of them, offers them a large sum of money if they will give him an everlasting gobstopper when they come out. So this is the end of the movie. Charlie and his granda are here. They come in to see Mr. Wonka because they haven't won the prize and no other child is there. And Charlie's grandpa's really cross. And he says, what's wrong? Why is Charlie not winning the prize? He hasn't done anything wrong. And then Mr. Wonka turns around and lists all the things that Charlie has done wrong since he came into the factory. You get nothing, he says. And the grandpa's really angry, and he says, he gets down to Charlie and he says, we'll give the everlasting gobstopper to Slugworth. And then the movie freezes for a moment. Charlie stands still. He puts his hand in his pocket. He takes out the everlasting gobstopper and he sets it down on the table there beside Mr. Wonka, and he turns to leave. And Mr. Wonka, under his breath, says, a light in a dark world. And he turns around and he says, Charlie, you've won. See, what he was looking for was a child who had a different set of values to all the rest. The rest were all in the factory for what they could get. And if they couldn't get someone from the factory, they'd go and sell the gobstopper to Mr. Wonka's competition. Charlie wasn't there for that at all. He left the gobstopper on the table. He turned to leave. That's being salt and light. It's living your life to a different set of values. And those values stand out. They are light in a dark world. They are salt in a decaying world. If we have those values, the values of Christ in our lives. What about us? What about when they're sitting around the table and work gossiping about one of the other members of staff who doesn't happen to be in the room? What do? Are you salt and light? Or what about in the neighborhood where you live? When there are all sorts of things going on, you know, things that are wrong, what do? Are you salt and light? You know, I during the course of this week, I saw on YouTube a video of one of my colleagues in ministry, the Reverend Mervyn Gibson, who spoke at Twaddell Avenue Saturday a week ago. You can watch the video. It's on YouTube if you like. In fact, if you're a friend of mine on Facebook, I posted a link to it during the week. I don't know if you've seen the video. In the video, Mervyn, it's a colleague of mine. I know Mervyn really well. In the video, Mervyn expresses a whole series of opinions about the political situation in Northern Ireland, the flags dispute, the march not getting up past Twaddell. You can look at it for yourself. And he's perfectly entitled to have all the opinions that he has. I don't happen to agree with any of them, but he's perfectly entitled to have those opinions. However, here's the problem. He's not just a political representative. He's not just a citizen. He's a follower of Jesus Christ. If you watch the video, do you think he's being salt and light? That's what God's call in our lives is. It's a higher call. It's a greater loyalty. It's a more important reality. How good are we at doing that? No point pointing the finger at Mervyn if we don't point the finger at ourselves. Are we salt and light? We are called to confront. We are called to resist. The world is God's creation, and our work and involvement in it are part of the mission of God. We discovered that last week. But there's a problem. It's a problem with the world. The world, the Father made the world good, and he calls us into the world and into human society as salt and light. That's what he does. But here's the problem. We can love some things too much. We can love some things too much. The world is beautiful. What God has made is incredible. But it's not meant to be an ultimate value in our lives. But sometimes the things in the world can become like that. And John, in his first letter, talking to young believers about the world, these are, in fact, the very last words of John's first letter, says this, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." Keep yourselves from idols. You see, it turns out that almost anything in this world that God created can become an idol. Even the best of things. Our work can become an idol. It can become more important than anything else. Our influence and our perceived status can become an idol. It can become more important than anything else. Sex, all sorts of good things that God has made can become more important than anything else. They can become an idol. And it's not just at an individual level that this idolatry takes place. It's not just you and I as individuals who can be idolatrous. At the level of society, that happens too. It can be because as a society, we embrace consumerism, you know, or we embrace ethnic superiority. We're better than everybody else, or national pride, or health and wealth and happiness and the pursuit of them. These things can become idols. But something else is at work here too, something deeper and darker. Paul says, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the powers of this dark world, the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. The world around us and some stuff in the world that is actually good can become bad because it can become an idol. It can become the most important thing to us, more important than other things, more important than God. That makes it an idol. And behind that idolatry sometimes are the rulers and the powers and authorities. And we meet these sometimes in the earthly systems around us that bring injustice into human life, and sometimes in demonic activity itself. But whether we meet it in systems or demons, if you are a believer, you will meet this power and authority. And we are called to resist it. We are called to resist idolatry at every level in our own lives, in our national life, and in our international situation. We are called to resist idolatry. But we will only resist it. We will only resist the powers if we discern their existence. And the problem is that we are children of our culture, and so often we fail to see the presence of the powers, the presence of idolatry in commonly accepted features of life. We never think about it. For example, a number of years ago, I may have mentioned this example before in church, I can't remember, but a number of years ago in the province here, on the loyalist unionist side of things, there was a campaign going on called Have a Heart for the Union. And I remember talking to a colleague of mine who's a minister in the south of Ireland, very well-respected minister in our denomination, now a past moderator, and he said to me at that time how concerned he was about it, and I did a second take, concerned, what? What's wrong with that? And he said, well, think about it for a minute. What is the heart? The heart is the seat of God's presence in your life. The heart is the seat of all you are and all you do. What does Proverbs 4:23 say? Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from that. We need to be really careful who we give our hearts to. Because if we give our hearts entirely to something, it becomes an idol. It takes the place of God in our lives. And that's wrong. So what about your heart? Because you see, it turns out that when we have to resist the powers of darkness that abound in our world and that use the structures of this world to forward and advance the aims of the kingdom of darkness, it turns out that the greatest battleground in all creation lies in your own heart. It lies in my own heart. That's where I have to fight the battle of idolatry more than in any other place. I may have to do it in work. I may even have to do it in a church. I will certainly have to do it in society. But I have to do it in my own heart. Have to resist the temptation to idolatry, to putting something or someone in the place where only God should be. We need to confront by being salt and light. We need to resist the powers of darkness, wherever they are, and especially in our own hearts. And we need, thirdly, to suffer. And here's the toughest bit of the sermon. Just before Jesus calls us to live as salt and light in Matthew chapter 5, he says this, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me." That's not how we see suffering. Blessed are you, Jesus says, when this happens to you, okay? Jesus was talking to a generation of people for whom these words would mean imprisonment, would mean being lashed and beaten till you were almost dead, would mean crucifixion and all manner of human indignities. That's what it would mean for them. And Jesus says, blessed are you when this happens. It's not our view of suffering. How on earth can Jesus say that? In fact, not only is that not our view of suffering is usually the opposite. As in Jesus' day, we often see people suffering as a result of their own folly or their own ignorance or even their own evil. You know that extreme example you get in John chapter 9 when Jesus meets this man who was blind from birth, and his disciples say, who sinned? Was it the guy himself or was it his parents that he was born blind? When people suffer, they're to blame for it themselves. You know, that's kind of what we think. The point is that sometimes in this world you suffer, even though you do good. Even though you do the right thing, people still suffer. That's part of the problem. But this is more than unfortunate. Jesus is not only trying to underline the fact that if you're a Christian, you'll suffer for it. Jesus is saying that suffering is an integral part of the gospel. Chris Wright, in the book in which we base so much of this series this year, says this: the cross was the unavoidable cost of the mission of God. The cross was the unavoidable cost of the mission of God. Suffering is not just something that happens as a result of the gospel. Suffering is part of the gospel. And it is built into involvement with the mission of God. If the cross was the unavoidable cost for God, then it will be no difference for us. That's what Jesus said. Jesus said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. And Jesus never undersold this. He never pulled a wool over anybody's eyes about this. When people came to follow him, he told them about this up front before they started out. So when Ananias is sent to see Saul, the great Pharisee, the opponent, persecutor of the Christian church, and he's blinded now, and he's in Damascus, and he's praying, he's seeking God's will for his life, and God sends Ananias to him to heal him and to fill him with the Holy Spirit. And God says this to him, to Ananias, about Paul. He says, this man is my chosen instrument. I've got a job for him to do. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name. Up front, he says to Saul, I've got a job for you to do, and part of the job, not the consequence of the job, okay? You need to get this. Not the consequence of the job, but part of the job will be to suffer for my name. And this revelation, which was given to Ananias and that Ananias then gave to Saul, made a massive impact on his life. In fact, one commentator says this: the glue that united Paul's thought and life with the message he preached and the mission he conducted was his suffering as an apostle of Jesus Christ. Jesus said to Paul, the day that he was commissioned in Damascus, that he received his sight and was filled with the Holy Spirit, on that day, God said to him, you're going to suffer for me. What did Paul do ever after that? Paul saw his suffering as the validation of his commission. Paul knew that when he suffered, he knew he was doing what Jesus had called him to do. It says in Colossians chapter 1, verse 24, now I rejoice in what I am suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church. What was Paul saying there? He says something there that we maybe struggle to relate to. You know, Paul's saying, okay, I'm involved in the sufferings of Christ. I'm filling up those sufferings, the fund of them. I'm getting involved with Jesus. Not in the redemption of the world. Jesus had already done that. It is finished, he said. But the world had still to hear. The gospel had still to go out. And that gospel could only go out through suffering. And Paul says, puts his hand up and volunteers and says, I'm willing. I'll see it as a validation. Think of the Lord's Supper. I was saying this in a pastor group this week when I was leading a communion service. Think of the Lord's Supper. What God has revealed to you by the Lord's Supper? The God who saves the world through a suffering servant. So when Jesus tells Paul what it will mean to accept the commission, It was not just Jesus giving Paul the worst picture, you know. So if it was better than that, it would be a bonus. That's what we sometimes do. You know, say we want somebody to do something that maybe is going to be difficult. We tell them what it would be the worst, like, you know, and then we think, but it probably won't be like that. Probably better than that. And is that what Jesus was doing to Paul? Said, you know, you could end up dying, you know, but it probably won't be like that, you know. That wasn't what Jesus was doing. Jesus was revealing the nature of the calling. I was sitting in a home recently of a, I went to visit a minister who's been really having a tough time, a hard time. And in the work in which they're involved, because of the work that they're trying to do, the advancements they're trying to make, trying to bring the gospel to a particular situation, they have been under intolerable pressure, receiving all sorts of evil, horrible, ugly correspondence and all sorts of dreadful things. And I called at the house to see this minister just to offer some support. And they were out at a meeting, but their spouse was there. And so I spent a bit of time with their spouse and prayed with them before I left. But one of the things I was trying to say to their spouse was this, you know, if you can find it in your heart, if you and your spouse can find it in your heart somehow or other to gather by the Holy Spirit, the strength of God to stay where you are, some amazing things are going to happen. Why? Because suffering is the validation of the commission of God. God has come special things to do here, and if only you can find it in your heart to stay, you'll see it. Do you know that this is happening all over the world today? We get it easy, you know? All over the world today, believers are in prison. Believers are suffering in a thousand different ways because they follow Jesus Christ. But the incredible thing is that where suffering is taking place, the church is growing at a rate that cannot be stopped. Look at the church in China. The Communist Party tried to destroy the Christian church in China. They killed pastors, they imprisoned church leaders, they literally knocked down every church they could, every church building they could. During the Cultural Revolution, it was a nightmare time to be a believer in China. Do you know what the situation is? The situation is that by the year 2030, the most Christian nation on the planet will be China. It is projected that by 2030, there will be 250 million believers in China. There will be more Christians in China than the United States of America. They suffered. Suffering goes with the gospel and is exceptionally fruitful. Paul could never resign because he didn't want to suffer, because suffering was always part of the deal from day one. And the church is crying out for leaders like Paul who will embrace suffering so that the world can be won. You know, we make all sorts of excuses. You know, it's hard to be a Christian leader. Not everybody likes what we're doing. In a church like this, there's all sorts of difference of opinion. If you're a leader, you've got to confront people, and it's not very pleasant sometimes. They say things that you don't really want to hear. And so the temptation always is to back away, take the easy course. Let's not suffer for anything here. Let somebody else do the suffering. I'll just agree with the person making the complaint. Or else I could stand up like Paul stood up in all sorts of places, inside the church and in the public square, and say, this is who Jesus is, and this is what Jesus calls us to, and he paid the price for it. And all across the face of the Roman Empire, person after person came to faith in Christ, church after church was planted, God filled people with his Spirit and changed the Roman world. Why? Because Paul was prepared to confront salt and light, to resist idolatry in wherever he found it, and especially in his own heart, and willing to suffer, not as an indirect result of being a Christian, but as the thing that validated his call. What about you? What about me?